talking public art
with us, Louise and Laura from Francis Knight Public Art Consultancy.
Conversations with a range of arts practitioners, community activists, planning directors and design teams about how we can make places better by working with artists.
Our role as public art consultants is all about the delicate balance of client expectations to encourage new ways of seeing, developing relationships, connecting people and enabling the creative process.
Today we meet Kerry Lemon. Kerry creates research-led public artworks that are deeply interconnected with local ecosystems.
Each piece she makes draws on extensive research into specific neighbourhoods, highlighting the flora and fauna of each area in intimate small-scale works, or reintroducing into towns and cities traces of the plants and insects that might otherwise be thriving were it not for the intervention of pavements and buildings.
She makes work using a range of forms and media, from sculptures and collages through to interrelated materials, images and objects that subtly reference the delicately balanced varieties of species we know to be under threat from climate breakdown, pollution and development.
Often her artworks are the result of close collaboration with scientists, focusing on a regenerative approach and using sustainable materials and habitat restoration to support local biodiversity. Welcome, Kerry Lemon.
Thank you for joining us and welcome to Talking Public Art, Series 2. It's very exciting. We're talking about when we first met you, actually. And we're trying to remember, I don't know the year, but I know we were in the tiny little glass office in Maidstone and you came with your portfolio and it was quite a small little room that we had. But, you know, it was just full of your energy and just being colourful and everything. It was amazing. And we didn't really know much about you. So you kind of came and introduced yourself and you talked about the kind of work that you were doing. And at the time you were very much into, well, you had a great career working with luxury brands, doing illustration, and you were starting to forge that beginnings of public art, weren't you? Beginnings of thinking about or doing certain things. And I know we carried on to work with you on Conningbrook Lakes in Ashford and Springfield Mill in Maidstone, which was fantastic. Yeah. But we're really interested to know why that switch happened. What made you kind of begin to think, I mean, I love doing this work with luxury brands and, you know, but why am I, or what, how can I do something else? What was that switch? What made you think I'd like to do public art?
Well, I started out, like you said, in illustration.
Yeah.
I loved it. So you normally get started with editorial stuff. So that means like books and magazines.
Right.
And then I worked my way up and I started doing really big installations for luxury brands like Liberty and Harvey Nichols, like big murals or window displays. And I loved it. I'd done installation at uni and I'm obsessed with drawing. So the chance to kind of realise these kind of illustrations on a grand scale was really massively exciting. But I'm always super ambitious because you never know your luck. And when you work for kind of VM, which means visual merchandising, which means kind of shop display stuff, which is absolutely blood and brilliant. But every 6 to 8 weeks, they kind of peel it off and put it in the bin. It's all stuff on vinyls. It's temporary. I did a mural for Liberty, which I was really proud of. I'm still really proud of it. And that was up for 2 years, which is kind of a miracle in retail.
Good.
But
it's
not permanent. And so I sort of started to learn, okay, how do you get to make stuff that lasts? And how do you get to make stuff out of like metal and glass and stone? And then I was kind of like, okay, that's called public art. And within the arts, I think we all know, you sort of get put in a box and it's very hard once somebody's decided, oh, you're an illustrator, you do this, to get people to think of you in any other way. Because logically, obviously, if I can draw a big tree that gets turned into vinyl and stuck on a piece of glass, it could equally be turned into metal and shoved in the floor. It's actually no different. It's the collaboration with the fabricator, with those really skilled craftspeople that help translate my ideas into different materials. But I had so much trouble getting people to kind of, it's that chicken and egg thing. No one believed I could do it till I could do it. And I realised I wasn't going to be able to apply for kind of public art jobs because I didn't have a portfolio with public art jobs in it.
Mm.
So I started to approach art consultants like yourselves directly, just to kind of see if they might start to consider me for smaller scale things or start to put me forward for things. And also I started going for like small scale developers that were interested in the arts. Because I just thought, well, if they're not of a scale where they'd go through an art consultant, I might kind of tick a box and solve a problem for them and not be competing with really, really experienced public artists. And that's actually the transition job that I got. So it was a company called Union Developments. Yeah. And I worked on this really big, like 18 metre by 6 metre laser cut brass piece for a building in East London. And it was great because once I had that in my portfolio, people were like, oh, she can do it. Just because it was out of metal and people could kind of be like, okay, she can work in different materials.
I mean, as public art consultants, you're right, invariably we're looking for someone with some track record because we can't always take the risk that we're going to work with an artist that hasn't delivered or hasn't worked with a fabricator or hasn't kind of gone through some of that process. But, you know, as an illustrator working with luxury brands, you've kind of gone through the same process. Yeah. It's just it wasn't a permanent piece.
Just translating it differently, aren't you? That's what you're doing.
Yeah. And to your credit, actually, Kerry, you did a complete charm offensive. I mean, we'd get the most beautiful printed material from you. And you'd send us samples of work as well, actually. It's kind of worth sharing, I think, because that led us to think, you kept popping up in our mind, you know, we were like, okay, what about Kerry? She's quite interesting, isn't she? We knew your work was associated with nature and you were illustrative, but in kind of a storytelling sort of way as well. So until we kind of came across the right project, and in fact we first started working with you in Conybrook Lakes, and in fact that was very much a written piece of work, so we were kind of doing a bit of strategy work, and we had a brilliant meeting, do you remember, where we were kind of looking at the commissions and what they could potentially be in a corridor with a big chart pad, fleshing out ideas, and we were kind of slowly evolving towards what those commissions could be. And we kind of hit a bit of a light bulb moment with them, with the four commissions that sort of rolled out from them. So, and that was the start of our working relationship with you. And then we went on to Springfield Mill, which had a glorious history and was great to work with.
Yeah, I loved that project.
Yeah, it was really interesting. But even having gone into public art now, you're on a bit of a journey with that, aren't you? Because once you put your foot in the door and you're in and you get a bit of a track record, you're now looking to become a B Corp a business yourself. We're kind of interested in that because what is that and why have you done that?
Okay, so I have just submitted, took 6 months of... Like, it's very, 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 very hard work. It's a lot of admin. Yeah. B Corp means you're a B Corporation. That means that you're a company that exists not just for the profit of the shareholders. You exist for people and planet. So my articles of association at Companies House have been changed to state that my company exists for people and planet. So,
but you can make a profit, though.
Yes, yeah. So it's not a charity. I'm still a limited company, but I'm about more than just making money.
Yes.
I'm trying to do good whilst I make money. And we can do that. We can all do that. We can all do better. And I want to keep doing better. B Corp is really hard work to apply for because it's really not one of those... You can't get away with it. You've got to prove everything you've said. Yeah, you really can't. And
you do like to make your life difficult, don't you, sometimes?
Oh, yeah. I just love the admin.
Yeah, you are very good at admin. I must
love it. But it's been amazing because it's made me have to think about every little thing I do and could I improve it? Mm. And things that... I mean, it was literally a chance encounter. So I'd heard of B Corp. So it's brands like Patagonia, Jamie Oliver. It's those sort of, I'd heard of like big companies that were B Corp, and I'd started to see this B logo on things. And the funny thing is, once somebody tells you about it, you notice it on loads of brands now. And the current assessment timeline is 8 months. That's how many people are in the queue to get assessed. Like, it is huge right now. There are so many companies trying to get accredited. And it only lasts for 2 years. So after 2 years, you've got to start all over again. So it's not like you just tick a box and you can forget about it.
Okay.
It's an ongoing system of improvement.
But it's quite, that's that should be how it should be, isn't it? Because if it's about certain quality and about, you know, not ticking boxes and having to do those things and keeping to those things, then I think if you become one and you can, every 2 years you have to keep telling them, you know, keep explaining or showing
and
them.
And it gets harder.
I'm sure it does. I think, you know, I think that's a good thing,
and
isn't
that's
it?
Definitely, that's why it appealed, because it was real, because it meant something.
Yes,
it wasn't just, oh, you pay all this money and you've got this logo. It was, you're part of a community who genuinely mean it, because if you didn't mean it, you absolutely wouldn't put yourself through it. It's a lot of hard work. And it's a chance encounter. I associated it with big companies, and it really is just me up in an attic. It's just me. I'm an artist. You know, I collaborate with amazing craftspeople and have different people that take on different roles for me. Mm. But I didn't think you could, you know, sort of be a one-woman band and be a B Corp.
Are there many artists that are doing it?
I don't know any that are. I was asked to speak on a panel at Clerkenwell Design Week.
Yeah.
As a kind of point of difference, because there's lots of kind of design-led companies that are either B Corps or in the process of becoming B Corps. But there may well be, but I don't know of any other artists. And when I spoke to the guy from B Corp, he didn't know of anyone. If there isn't, there will be, because through what I do, I was already doing a lot of people-y, planet-y things, but it was just sort of part of what I did, and I didn't really talk about it, and I didn't, it was just a way that I thought was a correct way to conduct myself. And then I sort of realised, oh, hang on, this is all stuff where I can kind of really think very hard about what I'm doing and see where I can improve it. And also, it's a real point of difference to what other artists are doing. And it makes me part of a community where I can kind of go to for advice and can kind of share ideas. And, you know, I've got a real thing about being open and transparent. So, because if you really believe that everyone needs to be improving their practices to leave a kind of social and environmental legacy, then you don't kind of not tell people how to do it. If you think it's how we should be doing it, you're open and you're honest and you say, oh, I work with this fabricator, I do it this way, you can look at this document, you know, I have like impact reports that are available for people. So it just made sense for me to do it, because it means that I have to hold myself to account, because I am the boss. So it means I don't get to go easy on myself, and I'm forever challenging myself to see where I can improve. And it's meant I've had to kind of go to all of my fabricators and go, right, like, I need you to kind of get on board with this. Otherwise, we can't keep working together, because our ethos has to be in line now.
Well, that's one of our major questions, because obviously you're working in the public realm, you know, and at the moment, you know, we are working on developments where, at the moment, material costs are escalating,
massively.
You know, trying to find the right materials. And sustainability is a big thing with developers. It has to be. Yeah. And for the work that we try and do in the public realm. So for you, that's quite a major change. As you say, talking to your fabricators, finding the right materials. How does that work then with you? So how are you finding your way through that kind of, it's like a minefield in a way, isn't it? Because we're used to stainless steel, we're used to Corten steel, we're used to sourcing from overseas, granite, you know.
Definitely.
And it's kind of getting, finding the pathways. How do you navigate that then? Because that's kind of has to change, doesn't it?
Where you use the materials.
Yeah.
And because I work in all different materials, so for example, if I made tables for posh interiors, I would get pretty good at making tables for posh interiors. But every commission is a different material, it's a different thing, it's a different Yeah, everything's different. So I'm definitely not putting myself out there as an expert. I'm saying, look, I'm here, I'm going to make mistakes, I'm trying to learn. And it's a constant balancing act because, okay, this material is closer than that one, so it's less transport costs, but actually it's harder to get this stuff out of the earth. This stuff's recycled, but actually, you know, it still needs to be robust. My main thing is, wherever possible, it's circular. So I don't. I want this stuff to last. I want it to be robust. I don't want it to end up in landfill. And wherever possible, I'm not bonding, I'm screwing and bolting so that, and I'm not coating so that things can be disassembled and go back into production at end of life rather than just ending up as landfill. I'm trying to replace all the materials I commonly use. So in the past, I've shipped granite from China. You know, I've used materials. And now I'm trying to work with suppliers to kind of go, okay, you know, I get my granite from a diamond manufacturer now. They get through all these discs of amazingly hard granite. And once they've used them for the diamonds, they've got nothing to do with them. They can't do anything with them. And I am buying virgin granite. So I reuse their granite. Metal, I've got a relationship with BMW. I'm going to be reusing all their car sunroofs. So I'm trying to, instead of buying mild steel, it's like, who's got mild steel already, scrap that I can reuse? You know, who's got stone that I can reuse? There's a lot of new generation materials that haven't yet been tested to the lengths where I could happily propose them to a local authority. A lot of the new generation materials, particularly the stuff with plastics, is only tested for interiors. It's not tested for the kind of weight loading stuff I need for the public realm. But more and more materials will be available. I just, for each project, have to look at the budget, have to look at...
I was going to say the budget must be,
Massively, because recycled materials, it's not a cost thing. It's not, it's any cheaper by the time you've kind of got it and you've put it into a, because you've often got to do quite a lot to it to make it suitable for your use. Instead of it being like a lovely pristine sheet, it's all funny shapes, and then when you want to get it laser cut, it's all got to be mapped because it's not the perfect square to go into the laser cutter anymore. It doesn't save money. Sometimes it costs more money, but it's the right thing to do because really, there's enough stuff in the world. We shouldn't be making more stuff. If you're going to make more stuff, and particularly, I mean, I make stuff that celebrates the natural world. I can't do that by contributing to its destruction. So there's such a disconnect between this kind of celebration of the world plus shipping granite from China. You know, so I'm trying to be a lot more thoughtful in everything I do. I will make mistakes. You know, there'll be things I do this year where next year I'm like, oh, I wish I'd known. I wouldn't have done it that way. And I'm open to criticism, to learning and to sharing.
That is part of the B Corp ethos as well, isn't it? It's not saying that we're perfect, but we're striving towards being better, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think there is that hard thing where the minute you say, right, I'm going to try and do this, there's a level of criticism that I probably wouldn't have got if I'd never stuck my head up. You know, if I kept my head down... but the minute you sort of put your head up and say, right, I'm going to try and do this, they're like, well, hang on, you know, how did you get to this meeting? You know, every little thing then gets criticised, which is right. You know, we should all be kind of checking on each other and holding each other to account. But
I think more and more clients are looking, particularly perhaps local authority, that the word sustainability comes up a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, it's quite a big word as well. And in terms of what that means, as you say, we're also looking for durability and robustness of materials. Yeah. We don't want to be putting materials into the public realm that do need replacing every 10 years.
No, you're making it worse, aren't you, in a way?
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of interested from our role as public art consultants. Yeah. So when, with your future projects and hopefully you achieve your B Corp certification, how do you see our role in working with you as an artist?
I guess it's advocating for what I'm trying to achieve. I think you're right that I've definitely, this genuinely isn't why I've done it, but I have noticed that I am winning jobs against other artists because I come with this kind of extra level of, you know, I have an advisory board for my company now. You know, I come with an ecologist and I come with, you know, I have 8 advisors for the company in different areas. And I mentor an artist of, you know, someone who identifies as either woman or neither for every project locally. So I do all these things on top of the brief. And I, you know, I'm interested in sustainability, regenerative sustainability. So I'm integrating kind of wildlife habitats into the structures I make, or collecting rainwater, or, and clients kind of are, you know, they sit up. It's interesting.
That, so they don't think, oh dear, this sounds like too, you know, we can't accommodate this. This is just too much work.
I haven't come across it yet. I mean, I think as a public artist, it's, if you can do it for the budget, great.
Mm.
I think it's having an understanding that all these, you know, so putting in animal habitats, there's not like a line within the budget for that.
No.
I'm inventing a line in the budget for that. So that has to come from somewhere. So yeah. I guess your role, I would hope, would be what it's always been, which is kind of backing me, which is what it's always been, which is always appreciated, and you're really good at it, which is kind of standing up for the artist, and kind of believing in what I'm trying to achieve and advocating for that with the client. Because I think with all these things, kind of in the initial meetings, they like the idea of it, and then once you start to talk about money and the fact, okay, it's going to have to be made out of this rather than this in order to do all these extra bits, it's still having that I haven't come across yet problems. Like if somebody, I'm very open and honest about what I'm trying to achieve, and so if somebody awards me the job, it's because they're probably on board with what I'm trying to achieve.
Yeah.
Otherwise they wouldn't give it to me, if they weren't interested in it, they'd give it to another artist. So far I've found nothing but excitement from clients. And also it's all these extra angles that you can talk to the community about, that you can engage the public in, that you can kind of go to the press about. There's like all these, the mentoring, you know, the employing women, the animal stuff, the ecology stuff.
So how do you get to the mentoring then? Sorry, Kerry. How do you kind of, with your mentoring then?
Yeah.
Kind of talk us through what you do with that then.
So the mentoring is absolutely huge to me. So my company, like I've said, exists for people and planet. So people means like, women. It's supporting women to do what I do broadly. I'm up against a lot of men on a lot of these jobs.
Yeah, you are.
And they are white, and they are in their sort of late 50s, 60s,
yes.
And they're highly experienced. And so I mentor with three national schemes. So UE Equity, which is Global Majority Students. So it's helping students like that kind of feel like they have someone they can talk to kind of extend their practice into the public realm. It's the Girls Network, which is giving women confidence. So I'm mentoring a woman from the Isle of Wight for that. And it's Arts Emergency, which is the kind of people that might have had free school meals or had quite challenging upbringings, and helping them to kind of have a network where they know someone who knows someone who could maybe get them a bit of work experience or help them out with something. So I do those three national schemes. And then for every project I'm awarded, I find a local artist, because what I want is, I'm really honoured by the fact I get to work all over the country. So, for example, I'm doing some work in Yorkshire. I'm not from Yorkshire. So by mentoring a local artist in Yorkshire, it means the next big project that comes up, there's somebody there who's capable of it. You know, they have work shadowed the entire process through from like all the community engagement. If possible, I offer them paid employment. It's not a paid position, but often they end up kind of taking on different parts of the role and getting paid for different things. They get to kind of see the testing, the kind of sampling, the first draft, the second draft, the final artwork, the fabrication, the installation. They see the whole project through. And then, you know, I've mentored informally for years, but it's something I formally do now. And it's not like end of job, bye-bye. It's, you know, people get in touch years later and go, I've got this contract, I can't make sense of it. Can you read it and tell me what you think? It's having someone where you can go, can you just help me? Because it's
kind of like what you kind of were looking for as well, weren't you?
Yeah.
You know, when you came to see us, you know, if there had been some, you know, if you'd been mentored as well, that would have helped, you know, immensely.
It would have been amazing. It would have been absolutely amazing, because there's so many incredible artists out there.
Yeah.
You know, there's women doing the most beautiful kind of tiny ceramics, which you look at it and you think that would look amazing if that was like 9 meters high.
Mm.
But they wouldn't know where to start. Yeah. They haven't got the confidence.
Yeah, I think it's the confidence. It's the confidence, isn't it? Because we've done some mentoring on projects, but I think when the artists have kind of applied for the projects, they haven't thought themselves confident enough or didn't have confidence in their own practice. And when you come to the end of, when we came to the end of the scheme, they flew. And you just, yeah. It just took one project where they were supported and then it could experience it for themselves. It's quite a process, isn't it, Kerry? Public art is not for the faint-hearted, I would say.
No, it's really not. And I would love to see mentoring being part of every brief because I think we all, if you're lucky enough to get to do this stuff, help someone else to do it. You know, I've done awful jobs. I know what it means to work for a living. This isn't working for a living. This is an absolute pleasure. And I want more people to get to do this stuff. And I went to a comp. I had a pretty rubbishy art education. We didn't know anyone. You know, I really had to find my way and it was hard to find my way. Yeah. And so now I've managed to get somewhere that I love. I'm 100% willing to say, who else wants to have a go? Because I'll help you because it is as good as you think it is. Being an artist is as great as you are hoping it will be. And I'll help you.
You are right, though, because I heard you say that, you know, artists can be quite secretive.
So secretive.
And I've got that. Why is that? It drives me mad. Art consultants can be as well.
Why do we do that? I'll tell anyone anything because I'm competing with the whole world. I'm competing with artists in Korea and France and Japan. You know, the fact that I've told someone in Kent which fabricator I use is neither here nor there. Like, it's irrelevant. Like, and if we should all be helping each other, we're stronger that way.
Yeah.
So that's actually written into my company. Like, you know, I've got, you know, a remit for my company, which is to be open and honest and share. And anyone wants to know anything, I'll tell you. I will tell you anything because what is the benefit for me keeping it all to myself? It's so silly. Right.
Yeah.
Like, why not be nice? Why not be kind and open and help each other?
So, Kerry, what would be your perfect project then?
Having
spoken about all of that.
Yes.
I know.
What would be your perfect project?
I'm so ambitious. I'm 41 now and I've never grown out of that whole, when I grow up, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And I still feel like that. I've always got like a wish list. I've always had that don't ask, don't get. You've got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
Phone them up. Send, like you said, you know, that I sent all these things to you and I sort of, you know, travelled to Kent. You know, I spent God knows how much on the train to travel to Kent to go to your office to meet you.
Down, didn't you? I mean, ridiculous journeys you were doing. Yeah.
Like, and I really invested in trying to, woo potential clients. Mm-hmm. And every penny I made, and initially I was making nothing, just went on like beautiful postcards and handwritten letters. And my whole company is based on being nice to people and sending people nice things in the post. And if they'll have a coffee with me, buying them a coffee. And because people buy from people, you know, you have to be, you know, you have to be all right at the work. You can't, churn out terrible work. Yeah. But
there's lots of people. You have to be genuine with it. And I think that's what came across, Kerry. We would get, dear Laura and Louise, would you like to come and see this? Or you even popped us, we had a sample or an offcut from something that you'd had cut.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And it was in the office for some time. And, you know, we'd get these beautiful, and they weren't flimsy, Kerry. You were sending us this
cost
beautiful
a fortune.
Print.
But
it was good because we could, you know, you could see that the quality of what your ambition was, you could see that, you know, and it was coming across. And it comes across, you know, it's not like you just stop doing that because you haven't.
No.
You know? So it's just that. And I think it is that fact that you just keep reinventing as well. And you are ready to change or to try something different. Because if that doesn't work, I'll try this then. And I think that's, you know, working in the public realm is hard. It's bloody hard work as well. So, you know, you have to have be tenacious.
It is hard work, but it's not cleaning a butcher's at 5 a.m, which is what I did at one point. You know, it's pyjamas, it's drawing something, which then winds up being a sculpture. It's amazing. It's like being a kid. You draw something and 3 years later it exists and it might exist for 50 years. You know, I cannot believe my luck.
So we have, so it's great. So that's, we have a lovely job as well. You know, we do love our job and it's not it's not work, it's not a job, it's just, yeah.
It's pleasure.
But there are bugbears and there are little things that niggle us.
Yeah.
So let's just quickly just go down a little hole.
Oh,
there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
good.
Go on then, tell us what, come on. What it
go
is
on.
That,
have
you know.
A good old
right.
Phone.
I roll up my non-existent
Yeah,
please.
Go on then.
My biggest bugbear is when you're employed really late on in a job. You know, when things have been designed to the nth degree and you've got a lovely big budget and you're trying to shove something somewhere, there's nowhere for it to go. It's all been done. And just think, if you'd have got me involved 5 years ago, you have bought furniture, you've bought fencing, you've bought all this stuff. And for not a lot more, that could have been bespoke artwork. All this stuff that you're buying very expensively.
From a catalogue, by the way.
Can be absolutely unique and bespoke. And then you get that cohesion because every element of this development makes sense together rather than like this weird jumble sale of I bought this from here and I bought that from there. If you get the artist kind of part of the design team, you get a really consistent look and feel. And it's such a shame because it's peanuts. It's not these developments are so much money, and to have an artist just being involved for those, you know, 5 years or whatever makes a huge difference to the eventual outcome. So my biggest bugbear is, you know, developments have been going on for years, you get pulled in at the last minute, they want something within 5 months. Why? I mean,
we get the same.
It drives me mad because it will only be so good and it can only contribute so much. So I would always plead, like, developers and local authorities, get the artist in super early and get them, have them as part of the design team. I love collaborating with architects and construction teams. And
it was interesting, actually, because we had a conversation with someone in a planning team recently, and from the local authority side of things, who said that one point when they were doing pre-apps, so they've come, pre-applications have come in, you know, more and more, he was asking for the landscape architect to be part of that team. He had to insist on that. Now it's a kind of given that a landscape architect will be part of that design team. And then he said to me, perhaps I should be asking for the artist to be on that team as well now. And I was like, yes, you should.
Yeah.
Yes, you should. Because actually, if they're bought in early enough, we can all work together and have true collaboration. And the public art, you might not even know is public art. Because it's embedded into the body of the scheme.
Everything, the paving and the cladding and the seating and the lighting. I think it all makes sense together.
I think also, you know, because we quite often, it's a planning condition and we get brought on, oh, we've got a planning condition, we've got to do public art, you know. And so so we have the same bugbear. And, you know, not every developer is like that, but some are, and local authorities. You're right, it's kind of shoehorning something in that doesn't make any sense and it's kind of plonked somewhere and then they go tick and you just think, no, that's really not what
doesn't
it's about.
Mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything, you know.
I'm just going to go back to my question because you didn't quite answer it, actually.
Is this about what's
your
next?
Your perfect project. What would be your perfect project?
Thank you. Yeah, I didn't answer that. So basically, I'm the queen of a business plan. So I've always got what's next in my head. So the public art, she touches wood and her touches her head, is all going really well. I've got more than I can handle, really. It's brilliant. So my perfect project at the minute is I'm trying to move the practice where I adore the public art. I never want to get rid of that because, I mean, no one is ever going to commission me to make like a £200,000 sculpture just for their back garden. You know, like getting to make these amazing things for these budgets that actually exist is incredible. I always want to be able to do that. But I also want a gallery practice where I get to make more fragile, more ephemeral work where I exhibit a lot more. So that's my current perfect project, is kind of moving into more exhibitions, being able to make kind of ephemeral stuff that is really, I mean, obviously stuff of the public realm, I'm like, okay, they're going to try and skateboard on it, they're going to go after it with like screwdrivers, you know, a really overweight drunk man's going to try and climb it at 3 a.m. They're going to spray paint it. The idea of something being, you know, in a hotel reception or in a gallery where it's behind a barrier, I mean, I don't want it behind a barrier, but you know, theoretically it doesn't have to be made of you know, it doesn't have to be cross-welded and reinforced to the hilt. That's thrilling, you know, to be able to make, because my work is all about the natural world and there's a fragility in that. And it's very hard to articulate that in these really robust materials. I'm trying my best and sometimes I succeed and sometimes I don't. But my perfect project at the minute is exhibitions. So I've been exhibiting a lot more this year, which is really exciting. And that's something I'm trying to work harder and harder on. And one of the members of my advisory board functions as a very strategic advisor to kind of help me, a bit like I said when I was trying to shift from illustration into public art. It's trying, now I'm at a point where people are like, oh, you do public art, and it's like, oh, this is so annoying. Like, yes I do work in public art, but why can't I just be an artist that does all sorts of different things? So it's trying to, I've worked really hard on my website to try and kind of,
it's beautiful,
rework all of that. It was an absolute jumble sale before, it's a lot better now. I've got a marketing advisor that's helped me with Instagram because that was chaotic. I've now got like a personal one and a work one because my work one just turned into like my husband, who is gorgeous and I'm completely in love with, but it's not very professional. So I've got like two Instagram accounts now. So I'm trying to like shift again. So dream project would be like an amazing, you know, gallery representation, international, amazing gorgeous, exhibitions. That's like the big, big long-term goal.
I would also say that... that practice, your personal practice, informs your public art anyway, doesn't it? There's many artists that we work with that kind of run parallel, you know, their actual practice, their personal practice really informs what they then
take. To me, it's all the same thing. It's not even separate. It's that it's all my practice. It's all my personal practice. It's just that sometimes it's massive and local authorities pay for it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's tiny and I make it for free and it goes in a gallery and it either sells or it
doesn't. You don't have to provide a maintenance schedule for it or anything.
No structural engineering required. I don't really have a separate... It's all me. It's all the same practice. It's just massive or it's little. And I've been working very hard on that. And also, you know, now... awful C word, COVID is starting to, we're starting to live with it a bit better. I'm starting to travel more and travel has always really informed my work. So the residencies have all started again, and residencies are massively important for me because they're a chance to make work where I can make bad work, because day to day I have to make good work. People are paying a lot of money. It's often public money and it's an honour to get to make work. You know, I get how lucky I am. So I try really hard to do a good job, but sometimes it's hard to take the risks and push it to the level where you mess it up.
Yeah, make a mistake.
Because you want to get it right. Whereas if it's a residency, I can make, you know, I'm doing 2 weeks at Ventnor Botanic Gardens on the Isle of Wight, and I plan to make like 2 weeks worth of terrible work because I'm going to push it and push it and push it until it all gets spoiled. But I will then have found a new limit and I would have learned so much. I've got a residency in Uganda next year, which I'm like massively excited, completely terrified about. And that will be another chance to kind of make uncommissioned stuff that goes wrong, where I learn a lot. And so residencies and travelling really, really inform the work. So that will have a massive impact on me. And I'm excited to be carving out time to do that. Ideally, I would be doing sort of 2 or 3 residencies every year, where you just get away from work where somebody's paying you, where you just make work that is fundamentally not good. But that's how you get better, is by making. Yeah. Otherwise, you play safe and you can repeat yourself and you don't find new challenges. You just kind of go, I know that works, I'll do that. Whereas if you draw something that's terrible and you set fire to half of it and then you use the ashes to draw with it, you're like, wow, I found a whole new thing.
Yeah.
And you're not going to do that when somebody's paying. You're not going to set fire to it halfway through. So
always so much to discover, Kerry. And I think we've kind of got to know you over the past 5-6 years, possibly.
Probably, yeah.
I think, you know, on and off, we've kind of worked over that time. But, you know, tell us a little known fact about yourself that we don't already know or might not have guessed.
Okay. I can't prove this because it's a podcast, but if you get to meet me, I will demonstrate this. I can tap dance very, very well. I love tap dancing. So I used to dance a lot when I was a kid. And I think I'm like one exam off being a tap dancing teacher.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, I've sort of bigged myself up. I probably can't do it like I used to be able to. But I can tap dance.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it's not something you really get to use as a skill day to day, but it's a secret skill and not many people know.
You can bring it out at a certain occasion.
Yeah. So if you meet me, the code word is tap dance, and I will do a triple time step, and you just have to go, wow, that's amazing.
I've been to many tap dancing shows with my daughters, actually. I'll take great interest in that. That's amazing. Yeah. Oh, dear. It's brilliant. And it's so good to talk to you about your practice and, you know, your ambitions with it, which are huge. Yeah. And, you know, it's great. It's great to talk to you about it and share some of that stuff. As you say, we don't want to keep it secret, do we? We want to share it with the artists looking to sort of go into the public realm, currently working in the public realm. For us, it's, you know, it's hugely inspirational as well to hear what you're doing, because you're pushing the boundaries and talking about things that we don't necessarily know about. And we have talked about sustainability and how we tackle some of those issues with our artists. And there are routes to improving it. So it's really good to hear.
Thank you. Definitely. So much.
The only thing I would say is, if anyone's listening and they want to be an artist, go for it. You have got nothing to lose. And it is absolutely amazing. And if I can do it, I mean, I went to a comp in Wootton Bassett in Wiltshire, you know. It doesn't matter if you don't know anyone. It doesn't matter if your family isn't arty. Like, go for it, because you get one shot at this. And it is, I have won the lottery. I know what it means to work for a living, and it's not this, it's brilliant. And if you want help, you can find me on Kerry Lemon and I'll help you.
Thank you so much. That's lovely. Thank you.
Thank you, Kerry.
Pleasure. Cheers.
Engaged, creative, curious, courageous and valued, Frances Knight is an award-winning independent public art consultancy based in Southeast England, with over 16 years' experience offering expert advice and management in commissioning high-quality art for the public realm. As co-founders and directors of the business, Louise Francis and Laura Knight commission professional artists from across the UK to create ambitious public realm artworks in a variety of locations. The consultancy partners closely with housing developers, design teams, social housing associations, and local authorities, together with a wide range of community groups, to create brave, ambitious, thought-provoking art for public spaces.
Over this series of podcasts, we will be looking at different ways that developers can engage with artists as part of a design team, and how, if it's done right, these working relationships can lead to meaningful, lasting and joyous contributions to our townscapes and landscapes.
In our next episode, we talk to Paul Cowell, Head of Culture and Libraries at Medway Council, about growing up in Bradford and being inspired by his mum's involvement with AmDram, creating environments and loving pavilions, the importance of words in public art.
Plus, the positive power of beauty, dreams of a giant bobble hat, and take that.
If you enjoyed this episode, we would really appreciate it if you could rate, review, and subscribe to our podcasts. It helps us spread the word on demystifying public art.